Tonight's lecture is dedicated to the memory of Sora Basaran Alevi, Cheryl Goldsmith Holzer, and her daughter, Atora Fega Razel Bas Yaakov, Atora Holzer, who so tragically passed away a year ago, and this week should be Li'ilui Nishmaso. The watershed of Jewish history, which is really the basis of all of the idea of Torah and mitzvahs and of the peculiar nature of the Jewish people, is the exodus from Egypt. You will notice that almost every mitzvah in the Torah has a reference, Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim. Every mitzvah is a remembrance, a reminder to us of the day that we went forth from Egypt. And that's not just limited to the holiday of Pesach, for instance, or the night of the Seder, which is devoted to the actual commemoration and is the anniversary date of the exodus from Egypt. But all of the mitzvahs, every Kiddush that we say Friday night, all the mitzvahs have within themselves that quality of being Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim, the remembrance of the exodus from Egypt. So the exodus from Egypt is not to be seen merely as an historic event. It's to be seen as the historic event in Jewish life. It is the event that made the Jewish people a nation, which molded them, which has preserved them. And the memory of that exodus is really what has enabled the Jewish people to survive all of the bitter tribulations and other exiles that we have undergone since Egypt. The story of the Exodus is as told to us in the Chumash and also as recorded in Egyptian records of the time, fairly straightforward. The Exodus takes place over a short period of time, less than 2 years, from the time that Moses first appears till the time that the Jewish people leave Egypt. In that period of time, the Egyptian nation somehow suffers a tremendous number of reverses, plagues, famine, disease, all sorts of natural disasters. Now, the great thing about a natural disaster is that you can see it as being natural or you can see it as being unnatural. And the Lord purposely does that in history. All of history can be interpreted, as secular historians do interpret it, as being a series of unconnected events that happen at random at best and are to be judged in such a fashion. Or if one wishes to, then one can see it as the hand of God, so to speak. One can see it in a completely different nature, completely different viewpoint. Well, it's the same thing in the plagues that occur to the Egyptians. Pharaoh himself declares, he says, that's not much of a trick. He said, I also have astrologers that can make plagues. By the way, all astrologers can make plagues. Nobody can make good things. That's part of the facet of government, is that the destruction, it's not hard to create, chaos. To do good things is harder. But he said, you know, it's no trick to turn the Nile into blood. We've done that before. It's no trick to bring about the tremendous influx of frogs. We've done that before. We can bring lice, etc. And we all know that lice does abound, that it exists, and that it likes human habitation. And therefore, none of that is anything special, Pharaoh says. The hardness of the heart of Pharaoh is because of the fact that he is able to interpret all of these matters, if he wishes to, in a not only a non-religious fashion, but in a fashion, in a cavalier fashion, of being a set of occurrences, of happenings, of accidents that occur, and that's what happened here. The thing that limits that, and that the Chumash points out to us all the time, is that Moshe calls the shots. It's one thing to have 10 natural disasters happen. It's another thing to have the 10 natural disasters predicted, and to be predicted at what time it's going to happen, and what time it's going to leave, and why it's happening. That already adds a different dimension to the entire matter. And that really is the essence of Moses' mission here, is not so much to bring about the disaster as to describe it to Pharaoh in advance, to warn him, to put him on notice. Now we see a number of historic parallelisms which always exist in history. Firstly, we see that the people always buckle before the leadership does. The people are ready to let the Jews go after the third Makkah already. His leading advisors say to him, Aterem Tedak Yovda Mitzroyim, don't you see what's happening here? But the megalomania of a leader, of a dictator, of an absolute king, of somebody who convinces himself that he's a god, that he doesn't even go to the washroom. So even when he has to go to the washroom, he somehow convinces himself that he's not going. I mean, the megalomania of people is just of kings, having never been a king, so I don't know how to describe, you know, what to attribute it to. But for instance, I was in the Rosenberg Palace in Copenhagen, which, it's a nice little palace. We could fit it in on Carlton Road, it would make it. And in that palace where they have a throne room, where they have has two sterling silver lions that are 4 foot high, and the magnificent everything, he has a commode, the king has a commode built into the wall. And it's built into the wall so secretly that you can go by it 100 times, you will never spot it. The only time you spot it is when the guide shows it. Because, again, it was considered to be unkingly. It was considered somehow to be less a majesty to suggest that the king was a human being and had, you know, he needed a bathroom. That's an inheritance from the original pharaoh. That's an inheritance from that megalomania. And therefore, Pharaoh is not willing to give in. Maimonides explains it very well, that wherever it says that God strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, it doesn't mean that God strengthened the heart of Pharaoh and he took away his free will. God gave him the stamina to be able to live up to what he wanted to do. A lot of times we would like to do something, except we're too weak. We can't stand the pressure. We buckle to the circumstances of the time. What God did here was allow Pharaoh to do whatever he darn well pleased. He wouldn't buckle to the circumstances. He didn't care. And you have, in our time, the terrible Pharaoh Hitler said that the German people deserved to be destroyed. He had no compassion upon them either, just he had no compassion on anybody else. He said they deserved to be destroyed. In 1944, when his generals told him that the war was lost, and that Germany should get out under whatever terms they can, and the Allies then began the bombing of all the major German cities and the destruction of almost a third of the German population. So Hitler said, no, they deserve it, you know. They weren't strong enough to win, so they deserve to be destroyed. The people always buckle before the leader, because it's the leader's insanity that forces the situation. And therefore, he is insane enough to want to keep it going. He is not ready to give in. And he had plenty of opportunities here in the Exodus, and he is never willing to, in any fashion whatsoever, to admit that somehow he was wrong, and somehow that the situation can be redressed. That's one historic lesson. The second historic lesson I mentioned to you in the last lecture, I'm not going to dwell on it again, but just to mention it, is that a vast majority of the Jewish people never get out of Egypt. 80% or more of the Jewish people die in Egypt, remain there. Only a small amount, even though everybody suffered, only a small amount come to see the eventual salvation, which is a terrible lesson of history, a painful lesson, and really not one that can be easily explained. But we see that again throughout Jewish history, that that's a fact, that everybody suffers and only very few get to the promised land, let's say. Third lesson that we see in the Exodus is that miraculous redemption no matter how miraculous and spectacular, is not long-lasting, because the nature of people always is, what have you done for me lately? And last week's miracle, as impressive as it may have been, it doesn't help me this week. And therefore, the foundation of faith and the foundation of a long-standing relationship between God and Israel, between Israel and itself, it has to be based on more than miracles. Miracles alone will not do it. We have some naive belief that if God would perform miracles for us, you know, then everybody would become an observant, a religious Jew, that all the problems would disappear, etc., etc. All of history tells us that that's not true. That's unlikely to happen, because the nature of human beings is such that miracles do not make a long-lasting contribution to us. We see that in God's relationship to Moshe. God gives Moshe signs. He tells Moshe that if you'll throw the staff on the floor and it'll turn into a serpent, if you'll put your hand inside your bosom, it'll turn leprous, and then you'll remove it and it will be healed again, that somehow all of that will make an impression. It's almost, so to speak, you'll see it in the Medrash and in the commentaries, it's almost, so to speak, that God is playing with him. Moshe says, well, how can I go to the Jewish people without miracles? They'll ask me. First thing they'll ask you for is a miracle. So God says, okay, I'll give you a miracle. But you see, it's not going to help you. It's not going to do it. The end will be that Moshe realizes that. Moshe realizes that miracles are not the way with the Jewish people. I don't know if they're the way with any human race, anybody in the human race, but they certainly are not the way with the Jewish people. The Jewish people are far too difficult to people to allow a little miracle to dissuade them from what they want to do. And therefore, as Moshe will say later, it's a stiff-necked, stubborn people. Stiff-necked, stubborn people means a people that's not influenced by outside phenomena. It's not influenced by miracles. It's not influenced by all. You know, here you have a people that you in the desert that the bread rains down from heaven. And be any kind of bread you want also, right? I think bagels were discovered there in the desert, you know. Guy wanted a bagel, and there were bagels. And anything you want is in the mon, any taste you want, and it's there every day. And you have miraculous water. The well of Miriam accompanies the Jewish people the entire 40 years. You have a traveling well. And you have an automatic dry cleaning service and protection from the sun in the middle of the desert. All of these things, right? And the people say, you know, where's God? What's God got to do with this? So that lesson is meant, a very important lesson. It's meant to point out to us that that's not how the Jewish people are going to be built. And in reality, over the thousands of years of our existence, all of Jewish history teaches us that it has to be built by inner conviction, by an inner strength, by a belief that is not dependent upon external events, or it's not dependent upon miraculous occurrences. It's not dependent upon any of that. Judaism is not a sideshow. It's not a circus. It's not a freak show. It doesn't have any lasting quality in that fashion. I remember that a number of years ago, there's a legend that exists among the Jewish people that the stones on Mount Sinai have embedded within them, like a fossil, the form of the burning bush. You ever hear of that legend? They have the form of the burning bush. And that no matter how you cut the stone, you'll always have that, you'll always have a piece of that form of the burning bush in it. So I remember, it must be 8 years ago or 10 years ago, new gimmick, a guy came from Israel, he's selling stones from Sinai. He's got the stones, and you know, in your front room, on your clean rug, he chops up the stone, and he shows you that, you know, it's got this bush, no matter what you do, it's always got the bush there, etc., and he's selling it for $18 a stone, whatever, and he's got letters from recognized rabbis attesting to it. So I told him, I said, what do I need the stone for? I said, I have the Torah. What do I need the stone for? So he looked at me like I was the one that was blasphemous. Because it's much easier to believe in the stone than in the Torah. There is a piece of us that says, you know, the stone proves it. Whereas if I have the entire Torah with all of the words in it and all of the tradition and all of our history, etc., that somehow doesn't prove it. But to a person with any sort of sophistication and any sort of intelligence, etc., will realize that the stone doesn't really do it. In fact, the stone can be very dangerous. What happens if, God forbid, the guy's a charlatan? What happens if he's got a little guy in, you know, in the old city painting bushes on stones, right? Could be. Everything can be. So then what? So then God is out of business. Then everything that we have said is not valid. That certainly can't be true. So therefore, that idea is also implicit in the Exodus, is that even though in the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of miracles, and we read it on Pesach, you know, and then and in Mitzrayim there were hundreds of makas, and on the Yom Suf there were four times as many makas, and there were every miracles upon miracles, but the miracles don't do it. Miracles are a great thing, and it's a way to get us out of the problem at hand, but it is not the basis of a religion, nor is it the basis of a commitment to Torah and a Torah way of life. That commitment requires an inner strength not built on the basis of miracles. In any event, on that great day of the 15th of Nisan, in the year 1312, before the Common Era, so we're going to celebrate now 3,300 years exactly from the Exodus of Egypt, this coming Pesach. I think so, 1312 and 1988, I think so. So on that day, the Jewish people go out. And the Egyptian economy is destroyed. Streets are literally strewn with the Egyptian dead from the plague of Makas Bechoros. The Jews were able to take a great deal of payment out with them for all of the years of slavery. As we read in the Torah of Bnei Yisrael, Yotzim Biyad Roma, the Jewish people went out with an upraised hand. They went out, they didn't sneak out like people who were engaged in a prison break. They went out as the victor after the 210-year sojourn, after the 80 years of slavery, after the final climactic 2 years of their existence there. So those Jews who survived went out. And the number, we are told, is 600,000 men from the age of 20 to 60. So it's approximately 2 million, 2.5 million people that went out. It's a large crowd, a lot of people. And the logistics of the matter itself are mind-boggling. And the Jewish people march along a route that takes them to the desert of Sinai. And the Torah tells us that God did not lead them along the road which leads directly to the land of Israel, and that would be the Via Maris, the road of the sea, the northern road which would lead Alexandria, El Arish, Gaza, which is the main road even today, and that's one of the oldest roads in the world, an ancient caravan track. But the Jewish people plunge into the heart of the desert, and they come to the Sea of Reeds, to Yam Suf, which it's hard to identify, in the Gulf of Suez, the Bitter Lakes, one of those areas. And there, Paro has a change of heart. The Pharaoh, after a number of days of contemplating the matter, realizes that the Jewish people may have left Egypt, but they find themselves in a terrible logistical situation, in a logistical situation that they have nothing to eat, and they have nothing to drink, and they have nowhere to go, and they're in an untrackable desert, and that they are lined up with their backs to the sea. something which every general will tell you, and an elementary thing in tactics and war, that you never line up your army with their backs to a river or to any body of water, because then your ability to retreat is almost destroyed, and your ability to maneuver is also destroyed. So Paro cannot resist the temptation. And when he cannot resist the temptation, he gathers what is left of the Egyptian army. And the Chumash describes it for us, the 600 chariots. The chariots in the time of Paro went in squadrons of three. That's why it says, V'sholishim al kulo. Sholishim, a sholish. He was the man that was in charge of three chariots. And the chariots charged like a triangle. The point of the triangle first and two on the flanks. The chariots had also knives and sharp instruments on the side of the chariot, so that three chariots could break through any line of infantry. If the horses did not panic, and the horses were trained not to panic, by going straight through, they would automatically cut the swath in the line of infantry, and chariots in the ancient world were what tanks are in our world. The Jews had no defense against chariots. They had no way to defend against it. They had none of their own. The Jews went out armed, but their arms were minimal. They were not a trained. They were not a trained army. They were an unarmed rabble, slaves. And now they see the entire situation that Paro is pursuing them. So here we have another lesson of history. All these lessons are always Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, that we should always remember what happened in Mitzrayim, because that gives us pause and hope and some insight into situations which happen later. The day before the Egyptian army is destroyed at Yam Suf, the Jewish people find themselves in a situation from which there is no exit. And there is no hope of victory, and there is no hope of ever getting out of this situation. So they find themselves in the most desperate situation possible. We find many times in history that God brings the Jewish people, and he brings other nations as well, literally to the brink of disaster. And the people don't realize that being at the brink of disaster is itself the means by which they will come to victory. Because if Paro would not have pursued them, then Paro would not have been destroyed. Then the remnants of the Egyptian army would not have been destroyed. And then the relationship with Egypt would not have been severed. And God therefore creates a situation where Egypt pursues the Jewish people. In the pursuit of the Jewish people, in their headlong rush to victory, they guarantee their defeat and their demise. And the Jewish people, in their moaning and in their troubles, are able therefore to see a miracle that to them was so unexpected that it brings forth from them spontaneous joy and song and all sorts of feelings of faith and emotion and hope for the future. The same thing is true in a person's life also. No one likes to be challenged, and no one likes to have troubles, and no one likes to have frustrations in life, but the truth of the matter is that all of those things usually are opportunities, and they present us with a situation from which a person can grow and succeed, be greater, and perhaps achieve more than he could have before. Many a successful person has become successful because he got fired from the original job. He got thrown out, or he had no future. I know myself a number of people who, if they would have gotten $50 a week more, so they would have stayed with the company forever. But because they didn't get the $50 and they couldn't make it, so they were forced to go out on their own, and then you're not talking $50 a week anymore, right? Then all of a sudden they became very, very successful. No, that's part of the idea of the Exodus. Part of the idea of the Exodus is that the troubles that befall the Jewish people have a ray of opportunity in them. That doesn't make it easier for the people on that night who have to lie out in the desert and camp surrounded by the Egyptian army, seeing the bonfires of the Egyptians and hearing their shouts and catcalls insults that they said, wait till tomorrow and we'll capture you all and we'll kill you all and we'll throw you all in the sea. That doesn't make any of that easier. But it does serve as a sort of a a signpost on the way. I think many of the problems that we see regarding the state of Israel today and problems in Jewish life generally, it's never quite as black as it looks, because there is an opportunity, and one never knows how the opportunity will turn out. And then when we look back in hindsight, we say, well, that wasn't so bad for us, because out of this, that, these good things flowed, these good things happened. But being human and being limited in our vision and in our time, etc., it's very hard for us to be that philosophic about the event when it occurs. We are told that the exodus of Egypt culminates with the splitting of the Red Sea, with the splitting of the sea. There are a number of insights there also, which the Chumash wants us to know. These are all historic insights. First insight is that the sea did not split into one path, but it split into 12 paths, and that every tribe had its own path. Now, that drive for individuality, which is the hallmark of the Jew, remains the hallmark of the Jew today. If there ever was a people, you know, we always say united. Why can't we all be united? Well, to say that the Jewish people are united is to say that they're not the Jewish people. The Jewish people are not, they're a fractious people. They're not given to that type of unity. There is a basic unity, which is the unity of faith, of belief, and the basic unity of destiny, that we're all bound together. But after that, there's very little unity. Different personalities, different ideas, different viewpoints. So here you had the Torah itself confirms it, because each tribe had its own way through the Red Sea. Now that's symbolic of the fact that each tribe is different. Our rabbis even state it more strongly when they say each tribe has its own gate to heaven. And therefore their prayers, the prayer of the tribe, goes up its own conduit. It doesn't go the conduit of the other one. And all of that is meant to help us understand that there is to be a lack of conformity among Jews, and therefore that requires a great deal of tolerance. And Jews are short on tolerance. Jews are very short on tolerance, not of non-Jews, but they're short of tolerance among themselves. And anyone that's not exactly the way I am, well, not only is he wrong, but after a period of time, I'm not certain that he has a right to exist, or to certainly to exist as a Jew, or to maintain his opinions. And rabbis say that that was the cause of the destruction of the Second Temple, was the unwillingness to grant to others the right not to conform. And therefore I hated them because of that, and that hatred eventually destroyed the Jewish people. Here at Yam Suf we see the different tracks of the Jewish people. And we see them in all of the variety that exists, in the 12 walls of water, the 13 walls of water, and the 12 channels through the Red Sea. And the Egyptians come charging headlong after them, attracted almost in a suicidal manner. And the waters recede, whatever force that kept the waters up now disappears, and the waters return to their original status, and all the Egyptians are drowned. Our rabbis tell us in one of the famous ideas that Paro escapes. He's the only one that escapes. So there's a good part and a bad part to that. But the bad part is that it's like, you know, there's always one malignant cell that you don't get. And he lives again. And he lives to repeat the same folly over again. And we find that with Agog, the king of Amalek, who survives just a little too long at the hands of King Saul. You find it throughout Jewish history. We're never quite able to put that disease to rest. We're never quite able to really vanquish our enemies in a permanent fashion. All we're able to do is succeed in a temporary fashion until the next time, but there always is the next time. And it will be that way until the end of time, until the end of Jewish destiny, until the Messianic era. There always is. You just don't get rid of it. So Paro survives. Now, together with the Jewish people, as I mentioned to you last week also, there went out a multitude of peoples, a mixture of peoples, an Erev Rav, who attached themselves to the Jewish people in order to get out. And these people attached themselves to the body of Israel, and they proved to be a very negative force among the Jewish people. All the problems in the desert, whenever there's a problem, they are part of the problem. They agitate, they're dissatisfied. They don't have within themselves the positive qualities of the Jewish people, but they have learned all the bad habits. And this Erev Rav is therefore seen to be as a negative force. Throughout Jewish history, therefore, there was an aversion towards people who wanted to become Jews, or people who wanted to come into the Jewish people. It's certainly an aversion on a mass basis. On an individual basis, the situation is quite different, but on a mass basis. And our rabbis tell us that Losi Lovo, in the time to come, in the Messianic era, that the Messiah, so to speak, will close the doors. That's it. No converts at all. No more. Part of that is simply because of the long collective memory of the Jewish people and the bad taste that we have. The historical bad taste of what the Erev Rav did to us. Now, the Jewish people, having gone out from Egypt, embark on a 40-year sojourn in the desert. And that also is a remarkable historic event. We have, probably in the annals of the human race, no similar event that a large number of people, remember we're talking about millions of people, exist in a vacuum, so to speak, in a historic and social, economic, physical vacuum, in the middle of this desert. And there they are to be molded and developed into a people. The commentaries all tell us that the Jewish people, when they went out of Egypt, were slave people. They had the mentality of slaves. And the mentality of slaves is lazy, slothful people who are not really interested in working very hard, and who have become secure in the fact that they're going to get three meals a day, and that their master is going to take care of them, and who are not cut out for independent decision-making or independent behavior. Moshe, therefore, has to take these people with these characteristics and make out of them a holy nation, make out of them an important nation, a civilized people. So this 40-year sojourn in the desert has to be seen as the greatest social experiment in the history of the world. A complete transformation of the people. And we'll see that the transformation did not occur without the death of the previous generation. The Ramban and others comment upon that, and they say that the generation of the slaves could not have taken over in Israel. They never would have been able to do it. They wouldn't have been able to conquer the country. They wouldn't have been able to settle the government. Because they were still slaves. You can give a slave his freedom, but you cannot free him of the mentality. You cannot free him of the habits, of the Weltanschauung that he has. And therefore, that slave mentality never was driven out. So it had to be their children who never lived in Egypt, who never were slaves, who never knew the exile, so to speak. They were the ones that were able to come and take the land of Israel and to establish under Yahushua a government and a country and an economy and to engage in the necessary physical struggle to maintain themselves and to build. That rule, again, that rule of history is a very painful rule, but we've seen it many times in history also, that there are just our certain generations who, because of the experiences that they have had, are unable to do certain things. And therefore it falls upon their children or their grandchildren or a different generation to accomplish and do that. Also, we see from the Exodus that when the Jewish people left Egypt, they left Egypt physically, but they did not leave it mentally. Egypt was always an option to them. They could always go back home. It's like a lot of American citizens who live in Israel, right? And they have the American passport. So, in reality, the American passport is no protection, if God forbid. They should need protection. But symbolically, in their mind, somehow it is, right? They'll always be able to get on the plane or go back to New York if the Arabs really start throwing stones. But if you think about it logically, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, the guy who's throwing the stone isn't going to ask you what passport you have. And if you show it to him, he's not going to recognize it. And it's of no consequence. But it's an option that you have because you haven't committed yourself fully. And as long as a person feels that he or she has an option, that he can return, that he's not that committed, he's not bound, so then he looks at it differently. Well, that's what happens to the Jewish people in the desert. Every time they have trouble, there is a faction that gets up and says, let's go back to Egypt. Nit no rosh v'no shuva mitzrayim. What are we doing? We'll go back to Egypt, right? We'll go back. So you have the great historic rule that you can never go back. That's true in a person's personal life. You just really to look backwards is not only painful, but it's counterproductive. Because you can't do it. You can never retract and you can never retrieve the situation. It's just gone. Do you ever take a job and after 2 weeks you know it's the wrong job? So you know it. That's it. So now you have to make the best of it. But you can't say, let's wind the clock back 2 weeks and I'll be back at my old job. It just doesn't work that way. And there are other areas of life that is true. So here, there is always this element that wants to return to Egypt. As impractical, unlikely, impossible as that can be. But they always say it. And we see it right after Yamsuf, immediately after Yamsuf, when they no longer had water to drink and when they didn't have enough food. So their complaint was, you took us out here in the desert to kill us. We're going to go back home. We're going to go home to Egypt, right? We'll strike a deal with Paro. Right? He'll give us better terms. We'll go back. And you also see a philosophy that Bertrand Russell coined it in our time with a phrase. He said, better red than dead, in which he opposed the arming of Western Europe against Russia, and he opposed the use of nuclear threat, at least, to prevent Russia from taking over all of Western Europe. He said, so the worst will be, it'll be red, right? Better red than dead. Well, not everybody feels that way. There are people who feel that red is dead. But here we see it in the Chumash, they express that to Moshe exactly. They say, why did you take us out here in the desert to die? We were better off in Egypt. Better to be a slave in Egypt than to die in the desert. So all of the lofty slogans about freedom and independence really don't ring true, at least as far as the Jewish people in the desert are concerned, because they're always willing to go back and be slaves. If it's an easier life, if it's a better life, if it's a more secure life, that's part of the problem. And that's a psychological and historic lesson that all of us have to deal with because that's a thread. I really feel that many of the liberal left-wing elements that exist in the Jewish people really would prefer to have it, you know, to be subservient, let's say, to the Arabs in a Palestinian state, and not to have the contention and the struggle that is involved in having a Jewish state. And that, we see, has very deep roots within the Jewish people, has ancient origins within the Jewish people. Let's go home to Egypt. Also, the Jews develop a nostalgia regarding Egypt. You know, Jews are great people for nostalgia. You ever speak to anyone that lived in Europe, so, you know, Europe was the greatest. You know, the Alte Heim, everything was terrific. Fiddler on the Roof became hundreds of millions of dollars successful because of nostalgia. So, you know, everybody thinks that that's what life was in the shtetl, right? They all sang and they all had a good time, and even though everybody was poor, but everybody was cheerful and happy, and eventually all the worst problems could be solved. But the reality of the situation was just the opposite. You were talking about terrible, terrible living conditions. Conditions that were so terrible that that's why people fled them at any expense, any excuse. But nostalgia does that to us. If you remember the house in which you were raised, and then you go back and you look at that house is a lot smaller than you ever imagined. In your mind's eye, it was much larger. It was much prettier. Maybe it's because we were small, we were little children, right? And the little small child automatically sees things larger. And a number of years ago, I traveled back to Chicago, so I wanted to see my old neighborhood, which is it's an impossibility today because it's an iron. There's almost no building standing. It looks like the old Lawndale neighborhood looks like a World War III hit it. Looks like the South Bronx, like all of these neighborhoods. But I went back, and in many of the buildings that I remember in my mind's eye, I mean, it's not only that they are graffitied and old and that the windows are broken out of them, but they're so much smaller than I remembered them. They're not as imposing. They don't have the grandeur that I imagined to it. Well, that's what nostalgia does to us. Nostalgia invests the past in a very rosy fashion, in a very unrealistic fashion. And that's what happens to the Jewish people in the desert regarding Egypt also. When they remember Egypt, oh, they say, Egypt, we had good food to eat. You know, we had pickles and cucumbers and watermelon and fish, and it was just great. And here, you know, you got to go out every day and collect the mon, and it's not as great. Well, that's nostalgia. And the nostalgia is a false picture. It's a dangerous picture. It seduces a person. I always say, the husband says to the wife, why can't you cook the way my mother did? Right. Well, he has to thank God that she doesn't cook the way his mother did, right? His mother couldn't burn water correctly, couldn't boil water. But he remembers, you know, that in his mother's house everything was perfect, right? And here it isn't. That's part of the psychology of nostalgia. It's part of the psychology of human beings, of how they deal. And the Jewish people in the desert, the Jewish people after the Exodus, that's how they dealt with Egypt. Egypt was always nostalgic to the Jewish people, and that's why there always was a Jewish colony in Egypt. Egypt had a soft spot in the Jewish psyche, and even though the Torah, I think that's probably the Maimonides said that's the reason why the Torah has to warn the Jewish people three times not to go back to Egypt. Because if it would not be a religious prohibition, everybody would want to go back to Egypt. Egypt has to itself an attraction. Even today it has an attraction. And just coming back from Eretz Yisrael. I was in Israel for 5 days last week. So in the hotel that I stayed, there were a number of tour groups that stayed. There were three or four tour groups were Christian tour groups. and then there were two or three Jewish tour groups. All the Jewish tour groups, without exception, also were going to Egypt. None of the Goyim were going to Egypt. And on the elevator, riding up with one of the non-Jewish tour groups and talking to them, I was on the 10th floor, slow elevator. So they mentioned the fact that they were only interested to come to Israel and to see and this and that and everything. But they said, Egypt is dirty, it's filthy, you don't have to catch disease there. You know, here, Jews don't talk like that, right? Jews want to go. It's one of the biggest tourist businesses in Israel is to go to Egypt. Because Egypt has a soft spot in the Jewish psyche. Later on in the time of the Second Temple, the Jews built in Alexandria a temple, Beis Chonio. They built a replica Beis HaMikdash, and they said, you know, this was the Beis HaMikdash for those who didn't like the other Beis HaMikdash, you know. It's the shtiebel I don't daven in. So they made it in Alexandria. And Egypt is an attractive place to Jews. It is part of our nostalgic memory, our collective nostalgic memory. And therefore, there always beats within us that refrain of Nitna Rosh V'Noshuva Mitzrayim. We are going to go back to Egypt, right? That's somehow an option. It's a way out for us. That's a very important thing to remember, because then we understand why the Jews always allied themselves with Egypt during the First Commonwealth and during the Second Commonwealth, and why they always were on the side of Ptolemy and against the Seleucids in the north, and why they always had the attraction to Egypt, and why Alexandria was almost an all-Jewish city. And during the entire time of the exile, literally till our time, there was a thriving Jewish community in Egypt. Jews always felt that they had a relationship there somehow. So that's another aspect of the Exodus that should be borne in mind, is the nostalgic point of view towards Egypt, which it brought about.
Nasser notwithstanding, is that feeling reciprocated by Egyptian?
Well, I mean, of the official Egyptian feeling is not that at all, and I don't know what the opinion of the Egyptian on the street would be, but my gut feeling is that the Egyptian on the street identifies more with the PLO than with the Israelis. I'm almost 100% convinced of that. But that's because the Egyptians, even though racially they are not the same as the Arabs, but they really are Arabs, and they're committed to the Arab struggle, and they see themselves as the leaders of the Arab world. I think that has a great deal to do with their situation and how they view us today. But they're certainly not very friendly, no. Now, the final point that we have to realize regarding the Exodus is that Moshe points out to the Jewish people a very hard lesson, that God takes them out for a purpose, that there really is no free lunch, and that there's a quid pro quo for their freedom. If they want to be a free people, so there is a purpose for their freedom. And just to exist as a free people, as noble an idea as that is, it's not going to be enough for the Jewish people. And that really is the beginning of his message to the Jewish people. And God says, I'll take you out, but when I take you out, you're going to worship me on this mountain. This mountain of Sinai, you're going to become a special people, etc. Otherwise, I'm not taking you out. And that's why the first of the Ten Commandments, which states, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, Asher Otzeisicha Meretz Mitzrayim, who has taken you forth from the land of Egypt. That commandment is meant to explain why God has a right to ask us the other nine commandments. Why shan't you steal, or why shan't you commit adultery, or kill, or anything else? It's because I took you out of Egypt. I took you out for a special purpose. And we find that repeated throughout the Chumash. You're my servants. I have strong requests. My document, my mortgage takes precedence. All of these words are meant to impress upon us the fact that we're taken out for a purpose. Now, that idea of freedom for a purpose is not necessarily only a Jewish idea, but it is such a Jewish idea that Jews cannot live without it, and that we see again throughout Jewish history, that whenever Jews achieve some sort of freedom, they have to do something with it. And they are not ever satisfied to be like the rest of the population. And they're not satisfied just to let things happen and to assume a role of passive enjoyment of their freedom. But freedom brings with it something. Now, that's a two-edged sword, because not all the nations of the world or not all the other citizens of the country appreciate that Jewish vitality, appreciate the drive. But if we see even secular Jews, irreligious Jews, they have to have something. So whether it becomes social ethics, or whether it becomes politics, or whether it becomes whatever cause, but there must be a cause. There must be some reason for the fact that I'm here and that I'm free. And that really was burned into the Jewish psyche at the Exodus from Egypt. I'm taking you out, God said, but I'm not taking you out that you're going to have a good time, and I'm not taking you out simply that you should be a good and free people. As noble as that is, that's not going to happen. What is going to happen is Tavdunas Elokim Alohor Hazeh, that you're going to have to worship God on this mountain, and that you're going to adopt upon yourself such great responsibilities, a holy people, a kingdom of priests, a nation that is unique in the world. You're going to have the burden of civilization. All of that is going to happen to you. And in effect, God gives us no choice. That's the quid pro quo for the Exodus. Otherwise, I would leave you in Egypt. Otherwise, I will leave you die in the desert. That's what it says. Rabbis tell us that at Sinai, God said, if you accept the Torah, good. If you don't accept the Torah, then this is your burial place. So that's not a threat. That's a statement of Jewish society. That's the way Jews operate. And we operate on the basis that we have a purpose, and that in the fulfillment of the purpose, everything is worth it. But if there is no purpose whatsoever, if we are purposeless, then our freedom means nothing. Now, Moshe emphasizes and reemphasizes over and over again that basic lesson in the Exodus. That the Exodus is not the end, but it's the beginning. It's the beginning of the acceptance of responsibility. Again, most nations in the world who have newly acquired freedom are unable to handle it, because again, you have a slave mentality, you have a subservient way of life that now undertakes great goals. Well, it doesn't always work, it doesn't always go, it's just too much. I think that's part of the answer why many of the emerging countries in the third world today don't make it, is because it is one thing to grant freedom, but it's another thing that after hundreds of years of being subservient and having that kind of mentality, and now all of a sudden you're an independent country, that doesn't make you independent. It doesn't give you the ability to deal as a free person and to make choices as a free person. So again, we see why God took the Jewish people out in the desert, and he didn't bring them directly into the land of Israel, because that would have been too much for them. We read that in the Chumash, that it says that God did not lead them on the road to Israel because the Jewish people would see war and they would go back to Egypt. Meaning that they would be unequal to the struggle. They would not be willing to wage that struggle. If war came upon them, then their solution would not be, so let us train an army, and let us defend ourselves, and let us be successful in war. their solution would be, you know, too many problems, a war, let's go back to Egypt. And all of the story of the Exodus revolves about that, the fact that Egypt has to be uprooted from the Jewish people in order to establish them as a free and independent and worthy people, the people that will be able to push their horizons forward and to be someone. And you have to be able to get that out of them. That's not easy. That's Moshe's task over 40 years. Next week we'll discuss the Jewish people in the desert and how they came to the promised land. But that's not an easy task, and it's not an easy task in our time either. I want to tell you, all of us know that. It's not easy. It's not easy to make... I think that that's probably one of the remarkable things that has happened in our time regarding the state of Israel is not its imperfections, but the fact that it works as well as it does. Because you have here a people who for 1900 years did not have their own country and did not have their own government. And then, I mean, we're still learning to fly by the seat of our pants. We're inventing it as we go along. And because of that, there are certain hang-ups, right? There's certain problems. It's not easy, but you have to keep it into perspective, and that is the perspective that the Chumash wishes us to see. So in this story of the Exodus, which is the great triumph of the Jewish people, we see, as we always do in the Chumash, that it is not just history, but it's destiny. It's not just looking backward, it's looking forward. It's not just highlighting the events, but highlighting the problems which exist as well. Because those problems are central to understanding Jewish history. They're central to understanding the problems that face us today. They're not really that different. And only in the light, therefore, being able to see it in that kind of a milieu, in that kind of a background, do we have a hope for success, and do we have a hope for our future and for our destiny as well?